testify, but two former chiefs of station would also be made available, if necessary, to appear in open court. Contents of classified operational cables were provided as evidence. Orkin's role was to deliver the critical testimony that linked the devices to Libya, illustrating a technological trail that started in Switzerland, progressed through Africa, and ended, tragically, in a field in the Scottish countryside. He was the single witness who would provide irrefutable scientific credibility to a detective story that began with a minuscule piece of plastic found by chance. But the trade-offs were stark. His presence at the trial would potentially blow his cover, and if he were identified, put his life and the lives of his family in jeopardy. To protect their identities, the court agreed that Orkin, along with the chiefs, could testify using alias names and wearing tailored disguises. The alias, Orkin, had been chosen some time earlier for the tech who had a reputation for clever puns and elaborate wordplay. He was Mr. Orkin, the bug killer. Whether the Libyans recognized the popular American extermination service was unknown, but as the trial date approached, the key witness became increasingly concerned with his choice of alias. What seemed amusing and fitting at the outset was now worrisome. Could the defense attorney somehow use the pseudonym to discredit his testimony? Was he being too clever in such a serious matter? To prepare the witness's disguises, OTS selected a senior disguise officer who combined a sense of artistry to fit the person to the materials, as well as match the materials to the subject. It was an exacting process. Orkin needed to not only look natural, he had to feel genuine within the disguise and be relaxed on the witness stand. The obscure OTS engineer would be transformed into the internationally recognized electronics expert, Mr. Orkin. The OTS disguise specialist eliminated Orkin's trademark facial hair, shaved here and added there where previously none existed. I had a nerdy old blue suit, white shirt. I almost put a piece of tape on my glasses to finish the effect, he remembered. Then there was a stink raised by the defense lawyers. They said, "We don't want people coming in here in Shirley Bassey fright wigs." When we finally sat down with the defense attorneys for a preliminary meeting, after 20 minutes or so of lawyer-type discussion, they asked, "Are you in disguise now?" I was, and they couldn't tell. So much for fright wigs. Orkin flew to the Netherlands and met with the prosecutors for a briefing on courtroom procedure. Using technology as evidence and experts to explain it was tricky business. Detailed scientific mumbo-jumbo could confuse those without a technical background, and engineers, trained to think and speak with precision, could be trapped by clever legal questioning. For example, Orkin was reminded, a lawyer might ask if a scientific result is 100% accurate, to which an engineer might answer in the negative, because the results were only 99.99% accurate. The possibility that the two suspects would escape justice through just such wordplay weighed heavily as the prosecutors prepped Orkin on how to make his data clearly understood in the courtroom. "We're going to ask you this, 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 and this, and we're going to establish your credentials," the prosecutor told Orkin. "Don't volunteer any more information. Just answer the question I ask you. I know what you know, and if I want more, I'll ask for it. If I don't, then let it go. But don't start expounding." Prosecutors warned Orkin that the two defense attorneys had already established a good cop, bad cop routine during the previous days of testimony. "They told me that one of the attorneys stands up, is a real sweet guy, and tries to get you to say something you shouldn't say. Then the other guy gets up, questions your parentage and everything else to try to get you upset," he recalled. Orkin arrived in court in his nerd disguise and spent 45 minutes on the witness stand answering questions for the prosecution. He detailed the elements of reverse engineering that linked the fragment to the timer and the timer back to Meebo. Whether the technical details confused the defense attorneys or they merely discounted the importance of the science was unclear. However, after Orkin's extensive prosecution testimony, the defense good cop attorney simply said, "No questions." The bad cop lawyer then rose and asked a question that revealed a naivete of technical matters. Isn't it true that all electrical devices contain electronic components? By definition, Orkin answered bluntly. No more questions followed. By the end of the proceedings, there was no doubt that the timers originating with Mebo ended up in the hands of the Libyan government. Added to the mountain of technical evidence was the testimony of two Toshiba Corporation employees who confirmed that in 1988, Libya purchased 20,000 cassette recorders of the same model that concealed the bomb. In all, the defense attorneys for the Libyan operatives called only three witnesses during the 84-day trial. On January 31, 2001, more than 13 years after Pan Am Flight 103 was destroyed, the three-judge panel returned a verdict, one conviction and one acquittal. The judges wrote, "The evidence, which we have considered up to this stage, satisfies us beyond reasonable doubt that the cause of the disaster was the explosion of an improvised explosive device, that device was contained within a Toshiba radio cassette player in a brown Samsonite suitcase along with various items of clothing, that clothing had been purchased in Mary's house, Sliema, Malta, and that the initiation of the explosion was triggered by the use of an MST-13 timer." The court found Abdulbasit Ali al-Megrahi, the mastermind of the plot, guilty of murder. His sentence was a minimum of 20 years imprisonment. His accomplice, Al-Amin Khalifa Fahimah, who authorities alleged supplied luggage tags and assisted in getting the brown suitcase placed on the flight, was found not guilty by virtue of lack of evidence. Terrorism moved from Scotland to sub-Saharan Africa when Al-Qaeda sponsored bombings of the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania on August 7, 1998. These were immediately followed by credible reports that other embassies in Africa, Europe, and Asia were also in danger of attack. A U.S. embassy in the Balkans was identified as a specific target. As a precaution, U.S. personnel were temporarily relocated to a compound outside the city. Shortly thereafter, the local security service captured one Al-Qaeda operative believed to be involved in the plotting, but a second suspected member of the cell remained at large. The at-large terrorist suspect, identified as a primary Al-Qaeda forger who specialized in altered travel documents, was married to a local woman who claimed to have no knowledge of her husband's whereabouts. His capture could produce a wealth of intelligence through the identification of the alias identities of other Al-Qaeda operatives, along with exemplars of their passports, driver's licenses, and other travel documents. The death and injury suffered by U.S. officials in the Nairobi bombing added special urgency to the search. Finding the other terrorist became an obsession for the handful of case officers and techs. OTS became involved in the hunt when the techs received word that communications had been intercepted between a suspected Al-Qaeda cell in Western Europe and the Balkan terrorist. One particular exchange suggested that the European cell was providing logistical support and funds to the Balkan cell through a female cutout. An operation combining OTS tracking and audio devices to find the terrorist was proposed. The concept involved implanting a tracking device as well as an audio transmitter in a package sent to the cutout, who could be expected to deliver it to the target. Although a solid plan from the intelligence gathering standpoint, the technical aspect was problematic. Placing an audio and tracking device in a small package would be difficult, as both would be transmitting for an indefinite time. In addition, after the modified package was inserted into the European postal system, it would be outside of CIA control. Finally, any suspicion of the package by someone in the supply chain would alert the terrorist to his vulnerability. Brian Mint, assigned to head the OTS tech team, understood the complexity of the operation and voiced his skepticism to the operational team. "We know he needs money," the senior case officer insisted. "He's gotten funds from Western Europe before, and he's looking for more. You put money in some package with tracking and audio devices, and we can get him." Although Mint's confidence that a technical package would work did not match that of the case officer, he assembled a team of engineers to tackle the problem. The tracking and audio devices would require a host that the target and cutout would accept without suspicion. Since money would be the bait, The package also needed to be large enough to accommodate several hundred dollars worth of European currency in small bills, along with the two devices. In that sense, the host needed to serve as concealment for spy gear as well as money, a gift holding two secrets. A tech was dispatched to look for suitable concealment hosts. European tourist trinkets offered the best options, since an inexpensive gift would not be alerting to customs officials or others handling the item during transit. The terrorist would likely assume the gift was more than it appeared based on its point of origin. Further, he would see the souvenir as a clever piece of tradecraft by his contacts and not examine the object more thoroughly once he discovered the hidden money. The psychological aspect of the double concealment was critical. The terrorist must have the intuitive sense to open it, but not suspect its second covert purpose. Since cavities could be made and restored most easily in wooden souvenirs, the tech settled on a 14x10x3/4-inch wooden wall plaque. Mounted on the plaque's face was a thin metallic plate engraved with the outline of an Italian cathedral and a script below reading, "Saint Susanna." The techs removed the metal faceplate and hollowed out a cavity in the center of the plaque large enough to hold small denomination bills worth several thousand dollars. An Arab linguist constructed a handwritten note. "Brother, we are with you. Hopefully this will get you by until we are able to contact you again." The faceplate was refastened to the front of the plaque with adhesive strong enough to hold it in place, but could be easily pried off. The techs then carved a second compartment at the edge of the plaque, large enough for electronics and batteries, for 2 weeks of continuous transmissions. The package, addressed to the cutout, was shipped with labeling to give it the appearance of originating with the European terrorist cell. An OTS team began monitoring the tracking and audio transmissions from specially equipped vehicles. We didn't know for certain where the package was going. All we knew was the address of the person we thought was the cutout, said Mint. If that assumption was wrong, the operation ended. Further, we didn't know if we would be able to keep our van with the audio receiver within the transmitting distance of the bug. We did what we could and hoped for the best. The techs tracked the delivery to the female cutout in the Balkans. Immediately opening the package, she read the Arabic language note, and 15 minutes later, with the package tucked under her arm, began walking across town. Tracking signals suggested she was performing a basic surveillance detection run by making several stops and doubling back on some streets. She boarded a bus that took her into one part of town, changed buses, and headed to a different section. The surveillance team, which was unobtrusively following, was eventually led to a neighborhood known for a militant Islamic presence. The cutout entered a two-story house with upper and lower apartments inside a walled compound. When she came out, she was not carrying the package. Local security established a 360-degree perimeter around the building, while the tech set up a listening post in a nearby house within range of the transmitter. An assault team assembled. The audio recorded talk among several unidentified people about the package, and then sounds of the metal plate being removed from the front of the plaque. The techs and case officers wanted to cheer as the concealment passed its first test. The target had recognized that the souvenir was more than it appeared and found the cavity concealing the money. The techs listened as an excited conversation between the terrorist and his wife was translated. The communication channel with the European cell was working. Throughout the afternoon, the techs continued to receive strong tracking signals from within the house, as well as audio. In the early evening, the terrorist's voice suddenly became agitated, and his wife sounded emotional. The techs speculated that perimeter surveillance might have been spotted as the terrorist had prepared to leave the house. Then the techs heard the distinctive sound of a weapon being cleared and a round chambered. After night had fallen and no more conversation was heard, the local operational commander directed an assault be launched. The techs listened to the commotion as the team entered the house and rushed to the second floor where the terrorist and his wife were believed to be. After a quarter hour of searching, the team reported they had not found the target. "I thought, how could this happen? We know he was in there. We had him," recalled Mint. "There were only two possibilities. Either he managed to slip through the security around the house, or he was still in there, hiding somewhere. Another hour of continued searching produced nothing. The wife claimed no knowledge of the suspect's whereabouts. Believing the operation had come to a dead end, the techs entered the house to retrieve the plaque, which they found opened underneath the bed of the second-floor apartment. Then, just as they turned toward the door to leave, pistol shots and bursts from automatic weapons fire came from the kitchen, followed by loud noises. The assault commander had continued searching the house and entered the kitchen for a final look. Either curiosity or policeman's instinct prompted him to move a small washing machine from against the wall. As he struggled with the surprisingly heavy appliance, a cavity between the back of the machine and the wall was exposed. At that moment, the armed terrorist, who had been hiding inside the washing machine, fired a single shot that hit the commander in the chest. Another nearby officer returned fire. The terrorist rolled out of the machine and continued to shoot until he was killed with a burst of automatic fire from the assault team. Closer inspection revealed that the working elements of the washing machine had been removed to create a hiding place just large enough for one person. Access to the concealment was obtained by removing the loosely attached tin backing and crawling through to the cavity. Press reports the following day made no mention of the agency's operational or technical role in the action, although the assault team, along with the wounded commander, received deserved accolades. The OTS techs were satisfied to have played an unpublicized role in removing another terrorist from the seemingly endless war. The six-member OTS Special Missions team would miss another New Year's Day with their families. Created in the mid-1980s to provide an immediate global response to acts of terrorism, the team was prepared to deploy within hours of being alerted. Team members were trained in post-blast investigation techniques and ordnance disposal, and for nearly two decades had disarmed bombs, thwarted terrorist attacks, and led foreign authorities to terror suspects. In more instances than the officers cared to remember, their urgent deployments inevitably clustered around the holiday season. Terrorists, it seemed, favored December for their murderous acts. In 1983, American and French embassies were bombed during December. Then a few days later, the Provisional Irish Republican Army planted an explosive device in London's most famous retail emporium, Harrods. Peruvian revolutionaries, under the banner of the Tupac Amaru Revolutionary Movement, took several hundred hostages at the Japanese ambassador's Lima residence in December 1996, and the same month a suicide bomber struck during an election rally in Sri Lanka, injuring the president. Libyan terrorists bombed Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland, just before Christmas 1988. Hamas blew up a West Bank restaurant in December 2000, and at about the same time, a bomb in India's parliament killed 13 men and women. However, December 2001 was not like previous years. The United States was at war with Al-Qaeda and its protector, the Afghan Taliban government, and the mission would take the bomb techs directly into the combat zone. Some of the team's members came from headquarters, while others flew in from field locations. All were volunteers. Little more than 2 months had passed from the first October airstrikes against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps to the liberation of the Afghan capital, Kabul. The Taliban and its Al-Qaeda cohorts were clearly on the run. While some Taliban forces were surrendering en masse in Kandahar, others had taken to the hills, literally hightailing it on horses and on foot to the White Mountain Range and honeycombed cave complexes of Tora Bora. While the large-scale military operations were all but over, and the rapidly advancing forward elements of the CIA's paramilitary units now faced only sporadic small-arms fighting, the country was still far from stable. As news broadcasts showed a jubilant population defiantly enjoying activities forbidden under Taliban rule, such as kite flying and men shaving off the formerly mandatory beards, the political and security situations remained dangerously volatile. The war itself was progressing with lightning speed, and within weeks, the agency's Afghanistan mission shifted from tactical support of the Northern Alliance to assuring a safe transition to a new government. The request for the OTS officers came as the Taliban abandoned control of the southern third of Afghanistan and the key city of Kandahar. The city had been among the last of the Taliban strongholds, and concern over what unpleasant surprises might be left behind was fully justified. The need for expertise in handling explosives and skills to assess, identify, and clear buildings of IEDs and conventional munitions became imperative. The team was given 72 hours to ready itself for deployment. The mission was as ambiguous as it was urgent. In reality, no one knew what the team would encounter on the ground or exactly what equipment was needed. Broadly defined, the team would provide ongoing explosive detection, assessment, and disarming capabilities for agency and military personnel. They would be operating in areas the Taliban and Al-Qaeda had controlled for years, some of it captured only days or hours earlier. They would also likely be called on to provide secondary functions, such as establishing emergency communications, field engineering, and photography. Intelligence reports from the field described hundreds of discoveries of tons of ordnance either discarded or cached during the country's two decades of nearly continuous warfare. This meant the team had to prepare to work with explosives of Russian, Chinese, and Pakistani origin, much of it unstable. Most would have to be destroyed to prevent it from falling into the hands of local warlords or opponents of the new government. Ironically, some ordnance and weapons were quite familiar to the OTS officers, as it came from stocks the CIA provided the Afghanistan Mujahideen during their 1980s war against Soviet occupiers. The team's housing would be primitive, and amenities such as electricity and running water scarce or non-existent. They would live next to the native population, some of whom were deeply suspicious of the new U.S. presence or still loyal to the Taliban. Almost every Afghan man was armed. The team could expect 16-hour workdays that would leave them covered in dust from unpaved roads and bat guano from caves in a hot combat zone to handle unstable explosives. Nevertheless, it was the kind of job they trained and lived to do. During an intense 36 hours, the team assembled enough gear, about 5,000 pounds, to sustain them for a series of operations whose length and intensity could not be known in advance. The gear they loaded into the C-17 Globemaster at Andrews Air Force Base outside Washington included everything from portable X-ray devices to explosives and ammunition. As the plane's cargo doors swung shut and the four jet engines were about to rev up, an urgent message arrived that a final package was en route. With the deadline for departure perilously close, they waited. Then an unmarked truck raced across the runway and pulled up to the plane. Lugging an ordinary-sized duffel bag from the truck, the courier presented a 3x5 card that served as a receipt for the package. "Just sign," the courier instructed the team leader, Mark Fairbairn. "You have a million in U.S. $100 bills bound in $10,000 stacks. Trust me, you don't have time to count it." Looking inside the bag, Mark saw stacks of bills held together by small lengths of cotton string. That was enough, and he signed the receipt. With the gear and million-dollar duffel bag secured, the plane lifted off into the night sky over Washington. Then, as the heavy transport gained altitude, the smell of burning electrical insulation filled the cavernous cargo area. The team did not argue with the pilot's decision to divert to Charleston, South Carolina, rather than continue the transatlantic flight with a cargo that included a good deal of explosives. After swapping out the 2.5 tons of gear to the second plane, the team took off for another try to cross the Atlantic. As soon as we were in the air, we were off the jump seats to find a spot on the floor to get some rest, remembered one tech. The only problem was we had packed away the sleeping bags and ground mats, so we slept on the metal floor with just our coats draped over us. After an uncomfortable night and already 6 hours behind schedule, they awoke in Ramstein, Germany, for a refueling stop. When airborne again, they continued on to Bahrain and from there to a secret airbase in Pakistan. Unable to make up for the 6-hour delay, and with dawn breaking, the techs were informed the plane would attempt a dangerous daytime landing, the first U.S. aircraft to do so since the war began. The southwest area of Pakistan, although not technically hostile territory, had yet to be declared completely secured. The airbase, which had first served as a launching point for search and rescue missions into Afghanistan, was now hosting large transport aircraft, such as C-130s and C-17s. The increasing Western presence ignited the ire of local militants, whose protests included random ground fire ranging from small arms to anti-aircraft guns. Pakistani armed forces found it difficult to suppress the dangerous but largely ineffective attacks. On approach, the team strapped themselves into their seats just in case the aircraft needed to deploy countermeasures or take evasive action. The precaution, to the team's relief, proved unnecessary, and after an uneventful landing, the tech set about offloading the two pallets of gear and rested in tents that had sprung up in the Boomtown airbase. They would make the trip to Kandahar that night under the cover of darkness. The final leg would be a 300-mile trip from Pakistan to Kandahar in Air Force MH-53J Pave-Low helicopters, outfitted with advanced avionics that allow flight close to the terrain's contours. The Pave-Lows were also heavily armed, with two miniguns on the side doors and a 50-caliber machine gun mounted at the rear. According to the plan, four Pave-Lows would fly in formation, crossing into Afghanistan, then separate. Two would go to Kandahar, and two to another base. Flight time was estimated at 3 hours, getting the team to Kandahar sometime after midnight. Just before dark, the techs loaded the two helicopters with the 2.5 tons of containers, boxes, and bags. An extensive pre-flight briefing covered topics ranging from landing positions to combat search and rescue, CSAR, procedures. Each team member was issued a Glock 9mm before boarding the craft. Bad luck boarded as well. A warning light blinking in the cockpit of one Pave-Low a short time after takeoff sent the OTS team back to Pakistan Airbase. Once on the ground, the team reloaded their gear and million-dollar duffel bag onto a new Pave-Low, only to be told the replacement helicopter also suffered from mechanical problems. At the last possible minute for the night operation to continue, the ground crew isolated and fixed the problem. As they lifted off from the base, the noise inside the Pave-Low drowned out conversation. Gunners positioned themselves at the open side doors, and the back ramp was opened for the 50-caliber gunner. Crossing into Afghanistan, all three gunners opened up and test-fired. Adding to the noise, the open doors created an uncomfortable internal wind tunnel. "Only then," recalled Mark, "did we learn what a cold, rough flight really was, when the helicopter began bouncing up and down from the wind of the southern mountain range." 3 hours later, the chopper hovered over bomb craters and debris before touching down on a dark runway of what was once a state-of-the-art airport. Built in the 1970s, Kandahar International Airport was at one time the largest and most modern in Central Asia, but it had been severely damaged in the Russian invasion in the early 1980s. After the Soviets left, the airport became a stronghold for Taliban and Al-Qaeda forces, which turned its runways into minefields. Recent U.S. bombing raids had added to the destruction, pockmarking the tarmac with deep craters and littering it with the debris of war. Now, with the airport recaptured by U.S. Marines and Pashtun guerrillas, control of the once modern structure, less than 20 miles outside Kandahar, signaled the end of the Taliban's fixed presence in the area. With the chopper's blade still turning, the team rushed to offload the gear in the 15 minutes the pilot allowed before taking off for the return flight to Pakistan. No reception committee greeted the six as the Pave-Low vanished into the night, leaving the team alone on the darkened runway at 4 o'clock in the morning. The team stood beside thousands of pounds of high-tech equipment and the money bag they had hauled from plane to plane and chopper to chopper, used en route as a pillow, footrest, and bed. Mark noticed that the strings securing the stacks of $100 bills had come untied, leaving a bag filled with 10,000 loose bills. Armed with only Glock 9mm sidearms, the team had no choice but to wait in the open on the runway. We'd been told that the Marines moved onto the airfield a few hours before, but they were nowhere to be seen, recalled a team member. We had no contact plan. Six sets of headlights suddenly popped up at about 300 meters and headed our way. We hoped they were friendly.